welcome back, folks, to this edition of the Hagman and Hagman Report. HagmanReport.com, that's our website. HomelandSecurityUS.com, that's mine. Also on our social networking site, just follow at Hagman Report or at Hagman PI. There for all of the programming information. And I want to thank everyone who submitted an article, Stephen Minking and Ted Brower and Peter Barry Chowka and others who have submitted articles to the Hagman Report. Great reading, of course, as always. Now, we've got a special guest with us. I wonder how many people have heard of Jeff Rorta. I have, actually. Very interesting. I just got a hand. Okay. Thank you. Okay. All right. Thanks. Thanks so much. I apologize, folks. Things happen with Eric not in. Eric the tech not in. It's kind of
it's probably at the beach.
Yeah, exactly. But Jeff Rorta is a retired police officer and a four-term Missouri state representative. He currently works as a business manager for the St. Louis Police Officers Association. That's a union that represents police in St. Louis, Missouri. He's a monthly columnist. He writes in a lot of places, actually. I learned of this gentleman in the wake of the Ferguson shooting, actually. There was an interesting article, and it was very pejorative to Mr. Rorta, to the extent that Mr. Rorta had made a post about the blood in Ferguson is on the hands of Mr. Obama, and I personally believe that. And of course, that was a very controversial post, and that's how I learned of this gentleman, and of course from his book, which I just really like a lot, "The War on Police," subtitled "How the Ferguson Effect is Making America Unsafe," and this book is it's the view from the policeman. It's a cop's eye view, one of the most turbulent times in American history for law enforcement, which has spawned a growing movement fueled by a biased news media and the group, including but not limited to Black Lives Matter. They demonize police all across the country, and they make, of course, being a police officer extremely unsafe. And having lost a good friend a number of years ago, leaving a widow and two children, I have a special place in my heart for police officers. I do know, look, I know that there are bad police officers out there, just like any other profession. But let's be realistic. They've got a tough job to do. And when the media is against them and they rile up the public with some skewed stats or some skewed information, or purposely biased information, it just goes nuts. But The War on Police, to me, is an important read. You can get that at the WND Superstore. Use the promo code Hagman. Jeff Rorta, thank you so much for joining our program today.
No, I'm glad to be here.
Man. Well, you've done it. You've written a book that really speaks the language of the police officer, I believe, the American police officer. You've done it, in my view, in a very measured way. You've really taken on the you've kind of contextualized what is taking place all across the country, how police are demonized, and what Ferguson did to this country. Should we start at Ferguson, given the fact that it seems that that's kind of basically where it seems like your life changed and your book starts? So should we start there?
Seems like the right place to start. I mean, that's where I was sort of thrust in the spotlight and forced to stand up for cops. Not that I didn't already stand up for cops. That's my day job. But, it brought it to a new level that I could have never imagined, that this would happen in our backyard. And it seemed so surreal to watch this thing unfold right before my eyes.
You know, the first chapter of your book, I believe it's called Ferganistan, something like that.
Ferganistan. Yeah, that's what the guys in the street called it, because it was a war zone.
Well, let's go back. I wonder how many people really know. And I mentioned at the opening of our program when we first began that I received an email. This is even before knowing that you were coming on, of what was it, Michael Brown? It was a picture of him. Let me see if I pull this up again here. Yeah, Michael Brown, hero. A picture of him. The top says, "I'm Michael Brown, I'm dead." And a picture of him with his arms folded, a scowl across his face. And below, it says, "Shot by a cop while I was trying to grab his gun right after I stole from a convenience store to Democrats. I'm a martyr." That's the entirety of the image that's floating around, apparently, in social networking. But all of that said, Ferguson, let's just get right into it. What the heck happened there?
Yeah, in the book, I call it the Lexington and Concord of the war on police, because that's the name of the book, and it seemed like the perfect name, because that's what we lived through in Ferguson. That's really what we're still living through. I mean, this war is not over. It's still at a boiling point. The battle wages on, and the purpose of the book was sort of twofold. I wanted to set the record straight on what happened in Ferguson and then talk about where we go from here. But, here's what, basically, we're still hearing the same hands up, don't shoot myth. You know, even though the grand jury investigation debunked that, the police investigation debunked that, the autopsy reports, the three autopsy reports, debunk that, and even Eric Holder's Justice Department. Don't we all know how badly they wanted to find wrongdoing on the part of Darren Wilson? Had to reach the unavoidable conclusion that he acted properly and that he was in a kill or be killed situation. But despite all that, despite what we now know happened, and that we know the hands up, don't shoot myth was just that, a blatant lie. The mainstream media is still reporting on this as if we don't know any of the truth. They still talk about it. When they talk about Ferguson, they say Michael Brown, an unarmed black teen shot by a white police officer, and don't put it in the full context of what we know happened that day, that Michael Brown was trying to disarm Darren and was trying to turn deadly violence against him.
Exactly. All right. Well, so you've got the media perpetuating the lies and the myth of this poor victim, unarmed victim, who really just must have been minding his own business, and he's dead because he's black. Okay, I mean, it's
the implication.
They've made this into a racial, such a racial issue. Well, it's incredible.
They have made it a racial issue, but I guess the question is, if we're going to get into this and how far back we're going to go, it's been a racial issue for a long time, and good and bad both ways. Some of the civil rights stuff we've seen, people still really are still angry about that, very angry. You have cases here and there where cops beating and killing people.
Well, okay,
that's what I'm saying. There's an attitude that goes along with this, whether it's racism or not, against the cops, and it stems from the more poverty ridden the communities are. It seems that these attitudes are higher, where communities will actually protect drug dealers instead of trying to rid their communities of that evil over the cops. So, and the whole reason I brought that up is because where does the problem stem from? But the media, as you said, will cherry pick these kind of cases to find the white cop versus the black guy who was shot for no reason whatsoever.
Right.
And it's interesting. This all plays into it.
Right. This most recent shooting up in Minneapolis where the person that was shot pretty clearly accidentally by a black police officer was a white Australian woman. So it's kind of atypical for a story like that to get as much media coverage as it's getting. But you're right. I mean, the narrative is certainly built around this idea that police officers are indiscriminately shooting black people for no good reason, and that happens more frequently than it does. You know, that's what I'm trying to push back against. You know, we talk a lot about the statistics in the book, the real world statistics. You know, the fact is that police officers shoot African Americans about half as frequently as they shoot white Americans. But, you know, a third of police shootings involve blacks, and about two-thirds involve whites, and there's almost no other races represented in those shootings statistics.
Right. But you never hear about that in the media. Never.
Yeah. I mean, if you put it in the proper context, I mean, you know, blacks don't represent a third of the population. They represent less than 20% of the population. But the fact of the matter is they represent about 60% of the people who are committing crimes. And it's, I know someone will scream that I'm a racist for throwing that statistic out there, but it's a matter of fact. And, you know, police officers come in contact more frequently with people who commit crime. And the fact that we're shooting blacks at the rate we are, I think implies that there's no racial motivation in these things. We, you know, cops come in contact with African Americans a lot because of the circumstance and the neighborhoods they find themselves in, and you know, the fact that we don't have more bad outcomes, I think, is reflective of the fact that the cops get it right an awful, awful lot of times. I mean, just imagine there's 750,000 cops or so across the country having dozens of contacts each every day with victims and witnesses and suspects. And you know, the fact that the media can only muster up one story every couple months that involves a white police officer and a black suspect that has, you know, some whiff of impropriety, I mean, I think that's shows what a good job cops are doing.
Yeah, I agree. When you look at the bigger picture,
and with the size of this country and as many cities and police departments, you'd think that incidents like this are happening every single day in multiple cities. In a, you know, every day, but the fact that they're not does say a lot.
Now, if you don't mind, let's spend some time on Ferguson, because again, people, you know, people have short memories, I believe, or and certainly the myths that have been created still continue. So, pretty much everything that was initially reported about Michael Brown, and about the police response and about the whole situation was dangerously misreported from the beginning. And then
that just
took on a life of its own, as your book points out. And by the way, folks, his book, The War on Police, How the Ferguson Effect is Making America Unsafe. Once you understand what happened in Ferguson, you can see that template being used by politicians and activists and groups like Black Lives Matter over and over again. But so the entirety, well, most of 99% of what happened in Ferguson with Michael Brown, this goes back to what, 2014, I believe, right? What was that? 20? Yeah, it was 2014.
Yeah, 2014. Yes.
Okay. All right. So, how did that? How did that evolve, and why, out of all of the officer-involved shootings, why this one, why then, why there? What was the spark plug behind Ferguson? What was
my frank answer to that is I think that it was sort of the perfect storm, you know, for the people that wanted to question law enforcement and sort of give law enforcement a black eye. You know, I the book kind of chronicles the year that followed that shooting. It starts with the day Michael Brown was shot and ends with the 1 year anniversary and all the violence that took place in Ferguson on that day. And I say in the book in the very beginning that, you know, I heard about the shooting and that day I talked to some coppers that were involved in the investigation, and they said, "Hey Jeff, it's a righteous shoot. The bad guy was going for the copper's gun. This is just sort of a nothing deal." And I thought, okay, well, good. That's, you know, that's that. And then, you know, the next morning, I wake up to a call from the police chief who says, hey, things really got bad there overnight, and we're really worried they're going to get worse. And it was, you know, it was largely due to, you know, Brown's accomplice, historian Johnson, that was with him when he robbed the liquor store, you know, started immediately telling the story in the community that Brown was trying to surrender, that he had his hands up, that he had his back to the officer, that he was on his knees. This this confabulation that the media bought into hook, line, and sinker. And, you know, he was telling it that day immediately after the shooting, and that's, you know, so they were having problems with a very violent crowd from the get-go, and, you know, by the next day, he was telling the story to the local media, and by the day after that, he was telling it to the national media. And this apparently righteous shooting that didn't seem to have any whiff of impropriety, all of a sudden is this police assassination of this innocent young black kid. And I think the Black Lives Matter movement was spawned by the Dorian, or the forgetting the name of the kid down in Florida that was shot by George Zimmerman.
So I keep wanting to say Skittles.
After that shooting, I think the Black Lives Matter movement was really in search of what they saw as a similar set of circumstances that involved the police instead of a private citizen. Because, and I think what they were looking for was a bigger media story that would have some panache and would also serve as sort of a proxy war against government and our way of life.
You know, we got some questions coming in from the audience, Jeff. And, you know, one thing that's interesting about some of these cases, the Michael Brown case and others, is lately we've seen all the cases that the media is bringing this slanted, biased opinion to, trying to, you know, sensationalize it. These cops have basically all been exonerated of, you know, what is perceived to be these racist hate crimes against, young black teens. And that seems to make their, that seems to lend credence to the mindset that, you know, the police are a corrupt institution and that, you know, this is just their way of being protected. So a question from an audience member is about Dallas. What happened in Dallas last year where the police were ambushed? And I wanted to ask you, in your research and your work, how that changes the mindset of the police when something like that happens.
Well, you know, police are already in sort of a foxhole mentality just as a function of the job. I mean, you have to have, you know, 360-degree situational awareness all the time. But, you know, that's the sort of sniper-style ambush of a cop is sort of their biggest fear because, you know, how do you defend against that? You know, you can't have your eyes on every rooftop. And you know, after Dallas and then Baton Rouge happened so quickly after that, you know, cops really felt like sitting ducks. You know, every time they're standing, you know, on the corner directing traffic or whatever sort of day-to-day function they're engaged in, you know, they feel like their number could be up at any moment's notice, and for no good reason. I mean, the shooter in Dallas, shooter in Baton Rouge were deranged men whose act of violence and hatred was motivated by all this anti-police talk and by a lie. I mean, the one thing I don't want your listeners to miss is that this is a myth, and sort of the cloudiness of the media reporting on this, and, you know, now we're going to see a Warner Brothers is about to write the Michael Brown's mother's book, and no doubt he'll be deified in whatever tearjerker story they produce that will be completely asymmetrical to the history of the thing. I mean, I just worry that in the murkiness of history, that Michael Brown is going to be remembered as this martyr, and Darren Wilson is going to be remembered as a murderer, and that that's a real injustice.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that. You know, I don't want to skip too much skipping around, but I think just going where I think we need to go. You know, thinking about how everything kind of turned sideways or went sideways with the police, in my view, anyway. I remember the 60s and 70s, in particular, the riots. And I got to tell you, I mean, I remember, of course, who doesn't remember, although this didn't involve police, Kent State. But again, that was the National Guard. But okay, the police authority type figure. And then that rebellious, of course, rebelliousness against the police. I remember all of that. And I remember, of course, and then history tells us too, you know, we had some police that of course were out of control, or arguably are out of control, I'm sure, didn't handle things well historically. But then, you know, things to me, and this is my assessment, and tell me if I'm wrong, and if I'm wrong, you know, I'll gladly admit it. So things kind of calmed down a little bit, it seemed like, or things kind of got a little bit less racially divided, a little bit less volatile. And then in comes Obama. And remember, it was back in 2009, like right around this time of year, you had Henry Louis Gates,
is it the beer summit?
Yeah, the Harvard professor who was arrested at his house. And then the beer summit took place. And that seemed to kind of change. To me, if I was to point at an incident, I'd point at that and say, you know, that kind of really changed things a lot. Because you had the putative president at the time, Obama, seemingly siding with, or seemingly calling the entirety of the police force in the country racist. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, but that's kind of what, to me, that's kind of where we turn the corner, in a sense. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a chapter in the book called Project Mayhem that kind of traces the roots of what led to Ferguson, and I talk a lot about the Henry Louis Gates thing in Cambridge, and what a miscarriage of justice the way the cops were treated there was. And you know, it seems to me like that this president, our immediate past president, was just had a problem with law enforcement. I think it probably stems from his past as a community organizer, and you know, he wanted to be critical of law enforcement. He was never a friend of the police, and it got worse with each passing year he's in the White House. And you know, he looked really dumb, frankly, after that deal in Cambridge. When the facts came to light, it was clear that he had jumped a gun and jumped to conclusions, and that's why he sort of ate a little crow and did that beer summit and tried to smooth things over. But you know, when Ferguson came around and Baltimore came around, he was very quick to pounce on those, to embrace the story, the narrative that was percolating in those places. And you know, I just think I think the country would have been better served, and he would have shown more leadership had he said, listen, we've got a system of laws in this country, and we have courts that work, and we're going to get to the bottom of this. We're going to find justice for everyone involved. But I'm just asking people to put down their rocks and torches and Molotov cocktails and go back in their homes and wait for justice to be done. You know, he was sort of uniquely positioned to make that call as our first African-American president. He did just the opposite. I think his words fomented a lot of the violence and a lot of the civil unrest. And you know, I think it, in the finality of the lens of history, he should be looked on dimly for that.
Yeah, indeed. I totally agree with you. You know what, folks, if you visit WND Superstore and the war on police. There is a trailer for the book there at WND Superstore. Watch that trailer. It's very interesting. It's perhaps nothing you haven't seen before, but the way it's compiled sends a message, I believe. And of course, the book itself, The War on Police, How the Ferguson Effect is Making America Unsafe. I must tell you that it does, the author, Jeff Rorta, really does a good job, takes a measured approach at the problem. It's not just, hey, police good, everyone else bad. No, I mean, it's an intellectual discourse into the problem of today. It really is, I believe, required reading for those who really want to understand how we got here in this mayhem that where we're seeing police as the targets of violence. And it's not right, especially when you've got family members, moms, dads, sisters, brothers, aunts, uncles, and children as police officers protecting our safety. Folks, again, our guest is Jeff Rorta. His book, The War on Police, How Ferguson Effect is Making America Unsafe, available at the WND Superstore. Use promo code Hagman. And we're going to be right back after our network break. 3 minutes. Stay right where you're at.
Visit HagmanReport.com for the news and articles that matter most. Stay tuned. We will be right back.
There shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time. No, nor ever shall be.
Folks, I'm going to direct your attention to MasterPreps.com. MasterPreps.com. Wow. MasterPreps.com, the sponsor of our show, MasterPreps.com. That's MasterPreps.com. Take a visit there. High-quality items, made-in-America items. I mean, anything, everything you possibly want, from cooking utensils, cooking frying pans. I mean, it is... It'll blow you away. Absolutely, Eric said.
It's insane. I mean, wow. Look at the products.
Folks, visit MasterPreps.com. Again, welcome to the Hagman and Hagman Report family, MasterPreps.com. I mean, wow, it's insane.
MasterPreps.com. Are you ready for what comes next?
Hi, I'm Grace Gonzalez from Caring Close in the Woods. We are an American family-owned company founded and built on skills and knowledge gained from responding to 18 major disasters in the U.S. and around the world. We found that most people don't have enough food and water to survive, let alone any medicinals to save their life. We're offering 25% off our must-have American Heritage Remedies Kit. It contains 12 homeopathic remedies, a booklet that goes over everything in your kit, and our brand new book, Major Disasters Lessons Learned. Just enter coupon code HAGMAN. In life or a disaster, you must be able to take care of yourself. You may not be a medical doctor, and your grandmother and your great-grandmother probably weren't either, but they still knew how to minister to their family's health issues, and so can you. Check out our American Heritage Remedies Kit at www.changeclothingwoods.com. Your life may depend on it.
Hello, everyone. This is Joe Charles, the guy whose voice is heard announcing for the Hagman and Hagman Report right here on YouTube and across the Global Star Radio Network. There have been many people wondering whose music is being played during those breaks. Well, you guessed it. And we're very pleased to announce that all that music and 11 brand new songs from the CD New Jerusalem is set for release on April 10th for download on iTunes. That means you can help support my ministry and be blessed by this awesome, inspiring recording. I have been fortunate to work with some phenomenal musicians from around the world that helped us put this recording together in the studio. Simply go to joecharlesmusic.com and click on the iTunes link. Or, if you'd rather have a CD, we'll send one right out to you. Just leave me your email and we'll get right back to you. And thanks to Doug and Joe Hagman for making this all possible. God bless.
We'll be right back. from Ferguson titled Forget It Then. Yeah, that's in the book. The book is called The War on Police, How the Ferguson Effect is Making America Unsafe. Go to WND Superstore. That's World Not Daily. WND Superstore. Use promo code Hagman. It's well worth a read. I've got to tell you, I've read it, and I've looked at it. You know, folks, look, 30 years as an investigator, I've got a lot of law enforcement, or friends in law enforcement, both, or whether they be local, state, federal, and, but I've known some real jerks too, okay? But very few. But to a T, every police officer I've spoken to, or agent I've spoken to, when the conversation has come up, and it doesn't come up that frequently, but when it does, it's unanimous. No one wants to pull their weapon. No one wants to shoot anybody. No one wants to be involved in an officer-involved shooting. First of all, it's too much paperwork. Second of all, well, it's just...
I would say that's true for 99.9% right. of the police.
Exactly.
Even here locally, there was just an incident that happened that wasn't a death or anything, or even a shooting, but the person who was involved, the officer who was involved, I know personally, and I know the kind of person he is. And it's the exact type that the police stay away from. You know, these people who get power trips and the authority God complex. But that one, you know, 0.1% ruins it for the rest.
And Officer Sean, if you're listening, don't forget we have a listener. Officer Sean is involved in an officer. He was involved in a shooting as well. You know, our prayers are with you, my friend. That's all I'm going to say, because you know who you are, and we know who you are, and we thank God for you and that you're safe. But having said that, our guest, Mr. Jeff Rorda, again, author of The War on Police, WND Superstore, use promo code Hagman. Jeff, thanks for holding over, and thanks for being with us. We can go in a number of different directions from here. The epicenter of your book is Ferguson. That's kind of where it starts, and, you know. If we haven't finished anything there, because we did kind of stray, go ahead and continue from there if you would like. Or if you want to switch directions, we can do that too. But we're still here at this point where the police are open. It's open season on police, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, the violence against police has gotten worse, not better. You know, I represent police officers every day. I can tell you they're getting shot at more frequently here. They're having to pull their weapon more frequently. They're having to use deadly force. I mentioned in the book, there were 8 young black men who were killed in confrontations with law enforcement in St. Louis City and St. Louis County in the 12 months after Michael Brown's shooting. And they all directed deadly violence towards the police officer. You know, 5 of them using a gun, 2 knives, and 1 a vehicle. And, I mean, that's not normal here. You know, in a year's time, we would expect in St. Louis and St. Louis County, which is about 1.3 million people, we'd expect to see 1 or 2 incidences where a police officer would have to take the life of somebody. And those violent, deadly months that followed Ferguson continue to this day. And you know, if your mission is that Black Lives Matter, you ought to just stop engaging in this hateful, deceitful rhetoric that drives young black men to violence against police officers. It usually ends in their own death, and also has a chilling effect on police officers doing their job, which disproportionately affects black people. You know, blacks are far more frequently the victims of crime, and when we prevent police officers from doing their job, blacks suffer more than anybody. So, I mean, this Black Lives Matter mantra really doesn't line up with the actions of this organized movement.
Amen to that. And the name that we neither one of us could remember, Trayvon Martin. Trayvon Martin.
Right.
Yeah. Back in 2013, I guess it was, but, or whenever it was. But the Black Lives Matter was established as a well, it was founded by Marxist revolutionaries in 2013. And, you know, it's interesting how they combine racism and sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, all the phobias, while openly promoting the murder of police officers. It's just, it's really ridiculous, and it's not the way we do things here in America. And as you well pointed out, the roots of Black Lives Matter, Elisa Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opal Tometi. I had done a video on all three of them, and I believe one was involved in a kidnapping, if I recall correctly. And I'm not going to go any further because I really can't. I'm not exactly 100% sure. But having said all of that, what do we do? How do we fix this? What do we need to do? Educate people. First of all, I would say educate people by your book is good education because it does have a lot of facts in there which we have not even touched. But how do we fix this? Can we fix it?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, we just got to be honest. I mean, we got to be honest about what happened in Ferguson and Staten Island and Baltimore and Milwaukee and all these places where they've had high-profile shootings. But more important, we also need to have a frank national conversation about race in America and policing in America. And, you know, while I'm a defender of the police, I also acknowledge that we don't get everything right. And I certainly acknowledge that, you know, racism is a very real thing, that, economic segregation is a very real thing, that people who are born with black skin suffered a worse fate than the rest of us. And that's not right, and we need to do something about it. And it threatens cops' lives, too. As long as we continue to have this vicious, violent cycle where because they're not much more than their skin color, people are born into poverty and into neighborhoods that are full of drugs and gangs and violence and broken homes. I mean, we're gonna continue to have these bad outcomes. And as you said, cops don't go to work saying, "Boy, who can I shoot today? This is the worst possible outcome of a contact between a cop and a citizen, other than the cop dying." You know, when they have to take a life, it's something that weighs heavily on them. It often destroys their career. You know, in the case of Darren Wilson, not only destroyed his career, he had to abandon his house in the dark of night to make sure his family didn't get murdered. You know, and he could never be a cop again. And you know, he's in financial ruin because of that. And you know, we have to have an honest conversation. There's another chapter in the book called Casualty of History, and I posit in the book that Darren Wilson is a casualty of history, but that so is the truth. In the lens of what we saw in Ferguson, and having seen the reporting of the mainstream media, I'll never watch TV again and say, "Oh, that's what happened." I'll always doubt, after the reporting I saw in Ferguson, that what I'm watching on TV is an accurate reflection of what happened. And that's a real shame.
I'm right there with you. In the 70s, late 70s, I worked EMS and responded to calls. And later, after the shift was over, watched the network news, local network news, and what they were saying versus what actually happened in a handful of cases I can specifically recall. totally wrong. And intentionally, the worst part was intentionally wrong. But that's another story for another day.
But that's why I wrote the book. I got tired of screaming at the TV. You know, it was like, "What are you going to do, dummy? Are you going to just let this happen, or are you going to set the record straight?" And, you know, writing a book is not easy, let me tell you. It's something I always wanted to do, and I'm glad I did it. But But it is a real undertaking, and it's you're really exposing yourself to the world, and it's very raw and challenging process.
Well, you and many people may not know that people know you as a four-term Missouri State Representative, but you're also a retired police officer.
Right.
Tell us about your experiences as a police officer. I mean, was it like this when you were a police officer? I mean,
So I was a cop for 17 years and worked in the St. Louis suburbs, but sort of the far suburbs where, you know, it was all white. But we had a lot of poverty in the suburbs that I worked in, a lot of crime, a lot of drug dealing. The county where I worked as a police officer led the nation 5 out of 10 years in methamphetamine lab seizures. So it was a rough place. A lot of drug trafficking. I worked undercover narcotics for 5 years, did over 100 undercover buys, and, you know, looked on the barrel of a gun on more than one occasion, rolled around the ditch fighting for my life with bad guys on more times than I care to count. But I look back at what I lived through and then compare it to what cops are living through now and think, boy, did I have it easy.
That says something, given what you described, and that's, I fully expect, after reading your book and speaking with you, but seeing, where is it here? There was a quote that was part of the description of your book. The embers, where is it here? The Obama administration chose to let the embers of civil unrest burn, fanned by the rhetoric of opportunistic race dividers. I don't see that going any, I mean, I still see that taking place, if not getting worse, especially because of, or, I don't want to lay this, it's not to blame President Donald Trump, but it's because of the reaction, some people's reactions to his election. You would think that, I thought that having Barack Obama would be a, would please the African American community in the United States. It apparently did not, or the Arab community in the United States, it did not. And then, of course, with the election of President Trump, the law and order president, I thought there would be a crackdown, or a better crackdown in law and order. We're not seeing that, at least at the level of the Department of Justice. But having said all of that, again, what do we do? What can we do as citizens to help this problem? To be the solution as opposed to part of the problem as citizens?
Yeah, well, I guess here, so I'll say this. The two chapters of the book that I'm most proud of are the last two chapters, where I really talk a lot about what we could be doing differently and how we could make this a better place to live. And, you know, we've got to do something about public education in this country. I mean, public education is met to be the ultimate equalizer, and it is met to provide an opportunity to anybody that's willing to work hard. And that's just not the case in a lot of these inner city schools. We try this one-size-fits-all approach to education in this country, and, you know, what works great in suburban Missouri and suburban America and rural America just isn't working in the inner city. And, you know, I conclude that, you know, we ought to look at some dramatic sort of sea change, paradigmatic changes in the way we build institutions and how these institutions function in the inner city. And, you know, we ought to consider, you know, barrack style housing, you know, for kids who, you know, who just have a home that doesn't work for them, and that schools have to be a safe place for these kids. But by the same token, they've got to work hard too. You know, I say in the book that in America, nobody should get anything for free except opportunity, abundant opportunity. And we're not providing that anymore, and we're particularly not providing it to kids in the inner city. And, you know, I think the main conclusion in the book is that Michael Brown lived in a desperate, hopeless, futureless life, and the reason that he decided to turn what could have been a routine interaction with Darren Wilson into a kill or be killed situation is because he saw no way out. And you know, if we don't start providing some opportunity or some glimmer of hope for kids in the inner city, and I'm not being a bleeding heart, mealy mouthed liberal here. I'm just saying that it's in everyone's best interest if we provide more opportunities. And if people don't avail themselves of those, shame on them. Then they shouldn't get anything else for free other than that opportunity. But you know, education and the ability to live in a safe community where you can walk down the street. I mean, these are things that we have to work on and have to change.
You know, I'm glad you stated exactly I'm glad you said exactly that, because when I was reading your book and I was going through the chapters, I'm not sure, maybe two-thirds of the way through, I'm thinking, wow, you know, we are in so much trouble. And then you do come across and you say, okay, you know, here's what we need to do, essentially. Or here's what we could do. Here are some good options, some workable options. And I sensed your, and I could be wrong, but I sensed your experience in government, to some extent as being influential in your unique experience being a police officer and also being part of the state government, kind of working in a symbiotic relationship to provide answers, solutions to the problems we're seeing. This is a systemic problem, and Michael Brown seems to be the poster child for that, in my view anyway, and I think based on what I've been reading in your book, Michael Brown's the poster child for where society is or has been brought or been allowed to digress to, devolve to, perhaps. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and right. And there are just too many Michael Browns in the world. There's too many kids that live in that same hopeless despair that I think he did. I mean, there's really nothing else that explains his actions that day. I mean, he was under the influence of marijuana, but I mean, that doesn't explain the utter rage, you know, that Darren described in his eyes. And for your listeners, I mean, I didn't mention this yet, but there's a one-on-one interview with Darren Wilson in the book. It's one of only three interviews he's done to date, and I'm pretty proud of the way I describe him and describe that interview, because he deserves to be humanized. People need to see Darren Wilson for the man that he is, and he, that hasn't been done anywhere else, and that's one of the reasons that writing the book is so important to me. And you know, the portion of each sale goes to Darren, by the way,
which I thought was very generous, folks. Again, a portion of the sale of the book, it does go to Darren Wilson. Your chapter in there, "We Are Darren Wilson," to me, hit home reading that. I'll just leave it at that. Good job on the interview. Very compelling and very I couldn't imagine. I just could not imagine being in that position.
Yeah, it was so important to me to not just humanize him, but for people to stand in his shoes for just a second, get a taste of what his life was like after Ferguson. I mean, I talk more about after Ferguson with him than I do the actual shooting, in part because the grand jury hadn't returned their verdict yet, and in part because I think that's the more compelling part of the story. And that was easy stuff to write. You know, the first half of the book where I sort of detail by detail go through what happened in Ferguson and debunk a lot of the myth. You know, it's sort of like I call it the Guadalcanal Diary of Ferguson. I mean, that was harder to write. And the writing was slow and sort of trudging on there, and it felt like I was, you know, doing a lot of fact-checking all the time. But when I got to the part where I'm just talking from the heart about Darren Wilson, talking from the heart about policing in America and race relations in America, that was easy to write. And I think it's the best part of the book.
Well, I do agree. And folks, I would urge everyone listening, if you're interested in where we're at, the police relationship, the relationship that we have as members of society, civilized society, with police officers, why things are the way they are with respect to the police officers and police departments, this is the book to get it at WorldNet Daily, WND Superstore. And you won't be sorry. I got to tell you, it's a very compelling book. It's a very parts of it. None of it's really hard to read or difficult to read. Some is difficult to really or surprising in terms of what you think you know, you really don't know. And when you find out the truth, and then you kind of verify it on your own, it's like, my goodness. How deep are the lies? The name of the book, of course, The War on Police, How the Ferguson Effect is Making America Unsafe. The author, Jeff Rorda, WND Superstore, promo code Hagman. We got about 2 minutes left. Any closing thoughts? The floor is yours.
Yeah. Here, I want people to read the book because it sets the record straight. But more importantly, I want them to understand the life of a cop and how difficult this job is every day and under the best of circumstances. And then when we get into an era like we're in right now, these last 3 years of this sort of post-Ferguson haze, I mean, it's made America a less safe place, just as the subtitle suggests. I mean, we're having trouble recruiting police officers, having trouble keeping police officers, and all of this is contributing to a less safe, less just, less civil society. And I think that the problem with the media is that they try to cater to what they think the audience is looking for. And I think we need to speak loudly and clearly as a country that this isn't what we're looking for, that we're looking for the truth, and we want some honesty about these situations, even if it's a harsh honesty.
Amen. And thank you for that honesty, and thank you for writing the book. I know it could not have been easy. It's a good read. It's a good book. I would urge, again, everyone to grab your copy of The War on Police, How the Ferguson Effect is Making America Unsafe. WND Superstore, promo code Hagman. Jeff Rorda, thank you so very much for your gift of time tonight. And taking your time out to talk about this very important subject, and my goodness, it's enlightening for sure, and it can also be inspirational as well, as you've led us to believe. Thank you.
Thanks for the time and for the kind words.
All right, sir. God bless you. Thank you.
You too.
Wow, ladies and gentlemen, it's you know the I just want to say this. Bruno, I remember the day you first taught me how to ride a motorcycle. You know, Bruno was a friend of mine, and he was shot in the line of duty, shot 3 times in a traffic stop in Texas, passed away, leaving his widow and his children. Never grew up to know him. And he was the nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. And here we are. Here we are today in America. There's a war on police. Yes, we know, of course, that militarization of police.
Yeah.
But you know what?
There's a war on police. The war on police is the war on authority to a great degree. to some degree, I should say. And there's a, you know, people when they talk about, some people when they talk about police, they just have this hatred for them for whatever reason. Maybe it's life experience, maybe misperception, whatever it is. But there are growing, as Mr. Rorda just pointed out, there are these ambushes against police. Probably the thing that is going to, if anything's going to make the situation worse, but executing police officers is the fast track to that end game, to the greater militarization of police, to the,
I agree,
you know, furthering of the tensions and division. And it's not even just a police problem. It's a community problem. It's a problem of evil overall.
Yeah, it is. And you know, that's one thing we didn't touch on, because this interview, just in case anyone's curious, this interview was a street level interview. Okay, this was not about the larger Hegelian dialectic of, you know, who's pulling the strings to cause the social division. This is about human beings. That's what this interview is about. Men and women going to work, putting on a uniform, and serving in that capacity. That's what this is all about. And that's what this book is about, too.
We'll be right back after this message. Don't go anywhere.
Just what kind of thriller predicts the future? In 3 days in the Belly of the Beast, Daniel Holdings wrote about the God Particle before CERN actually discovered the God Particle. In As the Darkness Falls, Daniel wrote about an Islamist terrorist confederacy that rose up out of Syria and declared a caliphate 3 years before ISIS was ever heard of. In his newest novel, Between the Veil, Daniel talks about a space between dimensions where supernatural beings can walk. He says that these novels are a warning from the Creator to his creation. Will war come to America? Will the world's economies collapse? Are we looking at increased earthquakes and volcanic activity? Will the United States fall into civil war? You can find all of Daniel's work at his website, danielholdings.com. That's danielholdings.com. All of these things and more are talked about in Daniel's books. To find out what's coming next, go to danielholdings.com.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high net worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes a secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.